So, I believe I have now gone over the table of issues in legal research. There were a number of people who done almost nothing but checking eCamps. It turned out the reason was they weren't in the class anymore. There were, I think, four people who, by my records, were missing one thing each, and I emailed all of them. So you should, if you're one of those people, you should have gotten the email, and you can tell me whether I've made a mistake in my records, and you really did do two issues in one legal research, or if not, fill in the last missing thing. I gather that nowadays teacher evaluations are done online. I hope all of you will feel free to give me advice. That is to tell me what are the ways in which you think, if I ever teach this course again, which I don't know if I'll end up doing or not, what would be ways of making it better, more interesting, what things worked, what things didn't work, and so forth. I'm in favor of feedback, and one of the limitations in teaching is that students are often reluctant to give feedback face-to-face because they're afraid they'll anger the professor or something like that. A world where everybody agreed with me would be a very boring place. So we're now talking about space, which seems to me sort of appropriate for the end of a science fictional course like this. And before what I mostly have is just a list of topics that could be discussed, but let me start with you. What are the things in this chapter or in this set of issues either you didn't understand? This is finally a point where the fact that my graduate degrees are in physics might be of some use, or alternatively, things that you wanted to talk about, were curious about, were interested about, and so forth. What were the things? Yes?
The space elevator has always wondered how you get around the burning up during entering the atmosphere. Just because you're going so slow and you don't burn up?
Why would you burn up entering the atmosphere from a space elevator?
Well, how fast does the elevator go? Start there.
Relative to what? The elevator is standing still.
Movement on the elevator, how fast does it go?
As fast as you want, I mean.
But at a certain point, doesn't it go so fast that the air compresses and becomes hot?
Why would a space elevator have to go any faster than any other elevator?
Well, because it would take forever otherwise.
Well, that maybe.
1,000 miles an hour, 1,000 kilometers an hour.
So but suppose it goes the speed. Suppose that it goes the speed of an airplane. Airplanes don't burn up. Right? Suppose it goes 500 miles an hour. That's a bit over 1,000 kilometers an hour. So you make it up to geosync in like half a day or something. What's the problem?
10 days,
1,000. Isn't that look? However, if you're lifting mass, right? Mass isn't in a hurry, right? The real question is how much energy it takes per pound to get it up there, not whether it takes a day or a week. I mean, this country was settled at a point when it took weeks to get across the Atlantic. I don't see the reason things burn up coming down from space is that they're falling, they're being accelerated at 1G for a long distance, so they get a very high velocity. But space elevator, you're controlling the velocity.
Well, it's the acceleration, not the speed that causes the.
No, it's the speed, but it's the acceleration that causes the speed.
Yes.
If you accelerate at 1G for very long, you'll be moving very, very fast. So, but in a space elevator, you're controlling the speed. Just like in the other elevator. So you make it whatever speed it turns out to work.
Do you know the temperature at which something would burn up?
Depends what the something is. I mean, you and I do very badly at 212. Dump you into boiling water and you die. Happens to lobsters, too. On the other hand, the piece of iron does just fine at 212. So that would depend what it was. But the other thing, of course, is that you, depending on how the space elevator is made, you could imagine a space elevator where in effect you had a solid mass of units going up and there would be only the side air friction. And of course, once you get very high, there isn't very much air.
Yeah.
Right? You're really only worried about the air for the first, whatever, 50 miles or something, or 100 miles, something like that. And beyond that, it's pretty thin. Yep.
Different topic, but how do you protect it from things floating around the atmosphere, space debris, and things of that sort?
That is, I'm not sure that floating around, I mean, I doubt that birds are going to do much damage to a space elevator. That is your... Well, you clearly want to make sure that there is nothing below geosync in exactly, no orbit intersects that. That's right.
Because in geosync, that's moving, nothing is shooting at it.
What?
Nothing is... So even if it's in geosync, it's there, it's moving.
Yes.
But other things could move in
Well, most things that are in geosync are also in geosync. That's the point of putting something at that particular distance out, right, is that you want it to be able to stay over the same part of the Earth all the time. That's why communication satellites are often in geosync.
Something coming across Mars at the space.
Coming across from where?
Anywhere. From outside the geosync. It does cross the geosync before it enters Earth's...
Space is very large, right? It's not like it's full of stuff. There are particular places are crowded, such as geosync itself, because it's very useful. But I wouldn't have supposed that the actual... Let me put it differently. How many collisions have we had so far of satellites? I don't know of any. Right? I think a space elevator really has two different sets of problems. There are the technical problems, of which the really big one is getting a strong enough material. And then there are political problems. And you're going to worry about whose permission do you need, who is going to... Is some enemy of whoever puts it up going to deliberately sabotage it and so forth? If something went wrong, where would it fall and what damage would it do and stuff like that? So those are conceivable issues. My guess is that if it falls, the top parts will burn up because then they will be accelerating at 1G. But hopefully it doesn't fall. But, of course, from those standpoints, some of the fancier versions really are less of a problem because if what you've got is this gigantic wheel that's spinning, you know, 50 with about the lowest point 50 miles above the ground, there isn't much 50 miles above the ground for people to worry about. It's not going to run into any airplanes, for example. You do want to make sure that airplanes don't run into the lower parts of your space elevator. It could be very embarrassing. Do people understand the sort of the mechanics of the space elevator or not? Because it's this crazy, really neat idea. And you know, you're hanging it from nothing, but you're taking advantage of the fact that beyond geosync, things want to go out because the centrifugal force more than balances gravity. Below, they want to go in. And one of the weirdest bits is the fact that you can actually mine the rotational energy of the Earth. That if you think about it, in radial terms, it's radial velocity staying the same. It's going around the Earth. But the farther out you are, the faster you've got to be moving to be going around the Earth each time. So that means, in fact, the thing going up the space elevator is being accelerated. What's accelerating it? Well, if you think about the mechanics of it, here's the Earth. The space elevator is going to be very slightly tilted, and it's going to be pulling, right? It's got the inertia of its load pulling, pushing back this way. What's the other end of that pull? It's the Earth that the space elevator is tethered to. So what you're doing is very, very, very slowly slow down the Earth as you put stuff up there, hence Clark's comment about the astronomers complaining that their clocks aren't running right because actually the Earth is turning more slowly. And I thought of sort of that somebody could do a science fiction story in which you come across a solar system in which the planets aren't rotating. And you realize that this is a place where they developed the space elevator technology. They used it for their interplanetary travel, and they used it all up. And then, presumably, their civilization crashed, because now they couldn't do interplanetary travel anymore. Not to mention the inconvenience of a planet that isn't turning. But it just struck me as sort of an amusing, sort of like people worry about our running out of oil. They ran out of rotational energy. Anyway, other comments, questions, things? Yes?
I didn't really grasp the mechanics of the spaceship. It's two, you have not using this for the right, so now you just have two fields coming out. It's supposed to be
here is more or less geosync. And here are two cables. Sorry. And the whole thing, in relative to Earth, it's moving this way. Alright? And the cables are rotating that way. Alright? So that means that when this is at its bottom point, if you've done it right, this velocity is exactly the opposite of that velocity. Hence, this is standing still with regard to it. So the example I gave is a turning wheel. It may not have occurred to you, but the wheels of your car are standing still. The bottom half of the wheel is probably touching. It is called a skin, right? Normally, the wheel, the rubber that's touching the road is standing still with regard to the road. Make sense? Not that it skids when it isn't. So it's standing still. So what it'll look like from the standpoint of somebody looking up on Earth, if you imagine there's a light, say, at the end of this, is that light is appears to be moving in this direction, because until it its maximum of this velocity went all the way down, right? Before that, so it appears to be moving slower and slower in this direction, reaches the bottom, and at the bottom it stops, and it then goes back up. So for an instant, it's still right there. So at that point, you look something like this. You've got a space plane which can get 50 miles up. How far up did Spaceship One go? More than 50, I think. Anybody know? Spaceship One won the Ansari X Prize, which was, I think, $1 million prize for making two flights of some height or other. You can look it up. Anyway, so you have something like Spaceship One but with a bigger cargo capacity, and it's got a load. So it hooks that load on this thing, and zip up it goes. That's the idea. And that's one of a variety of possible schemes for doing the equivalent space elevator less elegantly, but more easily. Yep.
About 60 miles.
60 miles. Yep. All right, so we've got 60 miles up, Spaceship One. Got 10 miles margin, safety margin. All right.
Is it feasible to set up multiple?
In principle. I don't see any, but yeah, I don't. My guess is that one will do it, but maybe not. Yeah. But in a sense, the basic idea is that if you think about it, a rocket is a horribly inefficient way of lifting stuff. It's sort of, most of its energy is going into the rocket, not into the payload. Whereas an elevator is a really efficient way. All you've got to do is to put energy to lift, to put in gravitational potential energy, essentially, by lifting. So it's a neat idea, and I also thought it was interesting that we make fun of the Russians for claiming they invented everything, but apparently they really did. The first person who proposed this was somebody nobody ever heard of, and then other people invented it later. So it's not that unusual. I think one of my published articles was plagiarized by a very famous economist about 30 years before I wrote it, and that's the central idea of it was the fact I discovered after writing it. Another of my articles, parts of it were by a much less famous economist, but also before I wrote it. So that's one of the risks of thinking of ideas. You discover someone else thought of them first. In this case, Artsunov apparently thought of that one first. And I hadn't realized until I was researching this stuff that the original idea of the multi-stage rocket was also by a Russian in the 1890s or something. Whose name I forget, but it's in the book. Anyway, so that was sort of fun. So maybe the Russians will build it. That could be neat if Russia actually turns around and becomes a successful, well-functioning society. Maybe some Russian, you know, multi-billionaire will say, "Aha! And for the glory of Russia, we're going to build a space elevator." Except I don't know where they'll put it because Russia doesn't have any territory on the equator just at the moment. Cuba gets close, I guess. Anyway, other comments, questions? Yes.
I don't know if you mentioned this, but how fast is the sail, the solar sail, how fast can that go? As fast as you want it to go?
Well, that depends how patient you are, right? That if the solar sail is getting a push from sunlight, and that push gives it a constant acceleration, if it's going outward, of course, eventually the push gets less and less as the... But there's no theoretical, I mean, the only theoretical limit is the speed of light, right? As long as it's going less than the speed of light, the light's pushing it, and it goes a little faster. Right? So beyond that, I mean, how fast it's going to accelerate is going to depend on the ratio of its area to its mass, right? The area of the sail is going to give how much sunlight it can reflect off, and that's how big a push it can get. And the mass of the whole thing depends on how fast it accelerates for a given push. Force equals mass times acceleration. So more mass is going to be less acceleration. All right. Is that reasonably clear? I don't mention in the chapter, by the way, another scheme for interstellar spaceships, which I think I invented and then discovered somebody else, of course, had invented first. And that's what's sometimes described as a ramjet. And if you think about the physics of a rocket ship, one of the really wasteful things... One of the problems with a rocket ship is you have to have reaction mass. You have something you throw backwards. And that means that the starting mass of the ship is partly the mass of whatever the energy is that's going to end up in the ship, but partly the mass of the energy is going to be in the reaction mass, its own mass plus its kinetic energy. Well, space isn't really a hard vacuum. Space has got this interstellar hydrogen in it. So if you only had an advanced enough engineering technology, your spaceship is moving through space and it's got this vast assembly of electric and magnetic fields out ahead of it, which are bending the interstellar hydrogen in so that it funnels into the ship, and then you can push the interstellar hydrogen back, which means that your reaction mass is coming from space rather than having to carry it with you. And that then gets you to the point where, in principle, in the limiting case, at the point when you've used up all of your energy source, the relativistic mass of the ship is the same as the physical mass of the ship was when you started. You can then do arithmetic and figure out how close to the speed of light you are according to what percentage of your mass was fuel when you started. Now, you can do a little better than that, because the ideal battery, of course, consists of large chunks of antimatter. And if you've got large chunks of antimatter, you can use some of this hydrogen coming in to burn up against them, and that gives you a battery with 200% of the theoretical maximum storage capacity, because all of the mass of the battery turns to energy plus all of the mass of the hydrogen you're annihilating with it. Right? The hydrogen and anti-hydrogen pair annihilate, you get an amount of energy equal to the sum mass of the two atoms. So that would be sort of a neat scheme too. But I don't think I can work out the engineering details quite yet. But it's one of the science fiction possibilities for spaceships. But all of these, of course, run into the same problem, that unless we're wrong about the speed of light limit, which my guess is we're not, though we could be, it's going to take a long time to get anywhere interesting outside of the solar system. So that means that with no scientific progress but engineering technological progress, you could imagine a lively civilization of trillions of people in the solar system. All right, in space habitats, maybe terraform a few planets, things like that. Getting interstellar without scientific breakthroughs, you've got to assume at least a 4-year trip to the nearest star, and many much longer than that to most other stars.
Didn't you say you don't think it's wrong about the speed of light?
I think the speed of light is probably a real limit, yeah. That's the current opinion of the people who did the experiments, yes.
Who did the experiments, their opinion?
Yeah, apparently, I gather, I haven't followed it very carefully, but as far as I can tell, like a couple of weeks ago, the story came out that somebody had spotted what the mistake was. Remember, the result was showing something going a tiny, tiny bit faster than the speed of light. And it's true that a tiny bit would be enough to show that the existing theory was wrong. But it's also true that a tiny bit looks a lot more like a mistake in the experiment than twice the speed of light would look like. If that makes sense. Right? You don't have to make a very large mistake to conclude that it's going 100.001% of the speed of light, which I don't know, that's exactly something like that. So, but anyway, no, apparently the current opinion is that it was a mistake. Just as the current opinion is that cold fusion was a mistake, which was an earlier scientific breakthrough that turned out not to be real. And, you know, those things happen. But I think probably most physicists' guess was that it was a mistake. That it just... But that's another story.
But if it is a mistake, and it turned out the speed faster than light, it opens a lot of opportunities for you to go.
Yes. If the speed of light limit is wrong, and there is some way of going much faster than the speed of light, then you can plausibly imagine an interstellar civilization sort of like the civilizations we've known. Whereas if you have that limit, you could still have an interstellar civilization, but any physical movement of stuff will be very slow. In fact, movement of information will be very slow, too. So you could imagine a civilization set with many stars settled, and people send radio messages back and forth that take 50 years to get there, and that could be useful, you know. Great novel, I'm willing to wait 50 years to get it, but it wouldn't be very much like anything that we're familiar with as a civilization. Other? Yeah?
So, I looked at the Lagrangian points.
Yes.
4 or 5. So, what I see is that you have one large and a small antennas and structures diagram, so you can do any properties for the moon and the earth as well.
Yeah. The Lagrangian points are the moon and the earth. There's a pair of those too, but those are inconveniently far away. whereas L4 and L5, what are normally called L4 and L5, are the Lagrangian points of the Earth Moon system, and they have the virtue that they are, a mere few hundred thousand miles away, and therefore, if we had good ways of getting up there, you could, I don't know what it is, the light said, 86,000 miles a second, right? So they're, something like a light second or two light seconds away, so you can have a phone conversation with somebody from there, and only a mild embarrassment due to the delay. No worse than delays you sometimes get on real world systems. There's actually an L5 society, I don't know if it's still going, but which was sort of dedicated to the idea of pushing space habitats at L5. That's sort of an interesting change over, I guess, my lifetime, between people imagining that if we could do science fiction stuff, of course we would go to other planets. And then someone making the point about the gravity well, the fact that it's really the hard way of doing things, and then having gotten out, you might as well stay out. And then people started thinking more seriously about space habitats. And asteroids, of course. And asteroids are, in a sense, a much better solution, because there's all that mass there. And you can do stuff with it. You don't have to lug it up from Earth. It's just going to be a pain, however you do it. Other things that start with
this? So one thing I was reading that getting up there is a big issue. But I think isn't it what keeps people from going up there is how to sustain themselves up there for a longer period of time, be self-sufficient without having to haul things back and forth. I'm not sure. If you want to live there a few days, you can get by things, but if you want to live there for a year or 2 years,
Yes, I would have said that those are engineering problems, but they're not engineering problems that require any basic science we don't already have. All right, we know how to grow plants, right? There's a whole lot of sunlight up there. So all you need is a really closed cycle system in which, everything gets recycled. And you have a power source, so what's the problem? Why not? Hard to destroy atoms.
Well, recycle into usable forms.
Why not? Where is there a fundamental? Obviously, it's not. I'm not saying I can build it, but where is there a fundamental problem? I mean, after all, Earth's been running that way for quite a while. We aren't getting supplies from space. Occasional meteor, but it's not what we eat. That is, we don't consume oxygen, we just combine oxygen with carbon. Right? We breathe in oxygen, and we breathe out the same amount of oxygen, we're just breathing it out as carbon dioxide.
But it's not usable in that form, so it has
to... So you then have a plant which, given input from sunlight, can break that carbon dioxide back into oxygen plus carbon that it uses to make food, basically. Right. So it seems to me that we do know in principle how to do it. Now, doing it well enough is going to be, the devil's in the details, so to speak. And presumably, if you actually tried to do it the first 6 times, you would discover you'd made some mistake and that something was building up or not getting... But I don't see, in principle, that it's all that hard a problem, because, as I say, natural biological systems do it every day. So all you need is a sealed environment in which everything that comes out goes back in, and you have a source of energy. And the sun, it wouldn't have to be the sun, it would be a nuclear reactor, but the sun is the obvious source of energy. And I don't know if the best way to do it is with plants, or if we knew enough, if we could, as it were, have a sort of a synthetic equivalent of photosynthesis. But we know it's doable because plants demonstrate that it's doable. You don't agree?
Well,
what am I missing?
I guess there's some basic needs that can be met, but if you look at a human who wants to live in it, for somebody in solitary confinement,
what do you mean solitary confinement? They're going to have an internet access.
Hospitals, schools.
Well, things like hospitals, there's just a question of how big it is. If you have a very small space habitat, you don't have room for a hospital, right? But if the space habitat is 100,000 people, lots of room out in space. 100,000 people, now it's got its own hospital, and it's got a couple of doctors. What are you missing?
I suppose like now, so like the larger scale gets the harder to push up.
Well, but the more worth it is to push up. That is the more you're getting out of it, so to speak. Right. That is, presumably you're going to start small, and the small ones indeed are not going to be sealed systems that are self-sufficient. And then after a while you get something big enough so that food and water and stuff recycle. But it's still the case that when there's a medical emergency you've got to send somebody back to Earth, and that's really costly. You've got to lift them back up again. And then 40 of those join all in L5 still, and now you've got a city, or maybe they don't join, maybe they just float within, you know, commuting distance of each other, so to speak. And you now have enough population to support your own doctor and your own hospital.
Did you try that with the space station? I know this stopped work after a while, but that was the idea that somebody would be able to fly there for a longer time.
Yes. And I think people were up there for a fairly substantial time, but I don't think it was ever intended to be a closed, self-sufficient environment. I think the assumption was always that, I'm pretty sure that food was always had to be brought. I'm pretty sure that's right. They probably recycled the air in some form. I don't know how, but that would be the obvious thing to do. And the water, I presume they recycle. I don't know the details of the space station. And it's sort of interesting. Part of what's interesting is thinking about what are hard problems and what are easy problems. So that I would have said that serious interstellar stuff maybe will happen someday. But I have no confidence that in 100 years there will be human beings on a planet around or anywhere around a star other than this one. On the other hand, if things don't go wrong, if there are no catastrophes, I think the odds are very high that 100 years from now there will be some noticeable number of people living off Earth. And they might be on an asteroid, they might be at L5, you know, they think of various other possibilities. But it looks like the sort of stuff we know how to do. It's just that without some more technological progress, it's undoably expensive. And without some engineering progress, we can't really do it, but we sort of know how to do the engineering in principle. That would be my view. So I think a plausible view. Now, I should say, in general, I'm trying to limit the book to about 30 years, and I'm not confident that in 30 years we'll have people living up there. We might. It's not impossible. But I think if you think about your lifespans, and especially if you're optimistic about life extension, but even without that, presumably most of you are going to still be alive 50 years from now. And some of you are still going to be alive 60 or 70 years from now. And I don't think it's absurd. You don't want to be alive 70 years from now? Horrible thought that you might be that old. Just trying to interpret the wrinkle
I'm
up.
Healthy, okay.
What?
If I'm still healthy, it's okay.
All right. Yeah. Okay. Well, you know what they say. Old age is pretty bad, but the alternative is worse.
I'm not so sure. Okay. The last 5 years of life, she cannot eat, she cannot move, she cannot talk.
Yes, my uncle was a similar story. I should say my uncle was one of the people who invented law in economics. I'm pretty sure that at some point 3 or 4 years before he died, he said something to the effect that he wanted to die. He lived like 102 or 103, and certainly the last couple of years, I mean, got to the point where he couldn't recognize me. But of course, old age doesn't have to be like that. I mean, my parents were both well into their 90s when they died, and my father was not as smart at 92 as he was at 60, but he was still smarter than most people I knew. And my wife's grandmother died at, I think, 104, and she was having some memory trouble, but she was a functional human being the last I saw her, which would have been within a year. But I say functional. I mean, she couldn't move very well. I can't remember what she was. She used a walker or something and things like that. But that's not, you know, as long as your mind is working and you're not in constant pain, it seems to me that...
If somewhere on the body there's itches, you can splash it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. No, I would say.
This isn't quite on that topic, I don't keep track of this, but haven't they reported some sort of health issues in people that have spent extended amounts of time?
I don't know what the current. Certainly, people have worried about that, and one of the issues they worry about is zero gravity.
Yes.
So that one of the questions is, whether or not the body would change as a result of that. There's quite a good science fiction novel by Heinlein, The Moon is the Harsh Mistress, and one of the assumptions is that if you've lived on the moon for a while, you can only go back to Earth as a cripple because your body has basically lost the ability to function in full gravity. But to begin with, we can do the equivalent of gravity via acceleration, so you can have a centrifuge. So if that's really a serious problem, you could imagine one of the models for space stations in the old science fiction stories, and one as far as it's workable, you've got a ring, the ring is rotating, it's rotating fast enough to give the illusion of gravity, which is, from a physical standpoint, just like real gravity. That's one of the things Einstein taught us, that acceleration and gravity are really the same thing. So that would be one solution. If it turns out that's a problem. But my impression is that we really don't know. That is, I may be wrong, but I haven't seen anything which said, yes, it's definite that the problem exists, but more, yes, it might exist. And of course, it might be that it's a problem only if people want to go back to Earth. Right? It might be that your body adapts to that environment, and you're fine in that environment. In fact, you say, what are all you people from Earth doing with all that useless muscle that you know makes you look ugly and fat, and us, we look like skeletons? Well, we're working just fine, right? That would be a not implausible. I don't know if anybody's done that. I bet somebody must have done that at some point as a science fiction.
Well, certainly mean you probably need less food.
That's right, sure. You're not carrying your own weight around.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I managed to lose a fair amount of weight over the last few months, partly because my wife was out of town for a month, which made it much easier for me to lose weight. No, what I was going to say is what keeps striking me is how little you can eat and still gain weight. That, you know, losing weight turned out to be pretty easy. You just eat almost nothing. But the problem is you have to keep eating almost nothing and it starts going up again. And so that suggests that I'm not sure if I really believe in any of the supposed theory of eating and weight and all the rest of it. Because it seems as though if I go up to like half what you see my standard, zip, the weight starts going up again. It's dreadful. But that is certainly a legitimate question in terms of this chapter, not one that I discussed, whether or not it would turn out that human beings depended on some hard-to-reproduce feature of Earth's environment. But, you know, it's pretty clear we don't depend on open space because there are people who live happily, you know, inside offices and things for long periods of time, and prisoners mostly don't go crazy from being confined and so forth. Now, of course, you may want to think about combining space with virtual reality. That's sort of my crack about, you have an internet connection before, that you could certainly imagine a space habitat, which is really a very, very Spartan place, but that's all right, because that's not where your mind is. You're inhabiting a illusion, a very attractive and interesting illusion, and you're interacting with anybody you want to who's within a light second or so that the time lags aren't too long. Even though your body is in this bare cubicle being fed some kind of mush that comes out of the recycling system. So that would be a possible future. So any of you want to write science fiction novels? Does it occur to you? Do you want to write novels at all? I'm curious about that. Does it seem to how many of you seems like a reasonable ambition that at some point in your life you would write a novel? Good for you. Right. Well, I'm giving away ideas. I actually have a page on my website which is giving away short story ideas, because from time to time I come up with what I think is a really clever short story idea that I don't want to write. And so I put them up. And I've had about two or three people who've written stories from my ideas, sent them to me, and they were neat because the story went in a direction that hadn't occurred to me when I came up with the idea. And of course, I webbed those with permission of the authors, and that was fun.
You make that as a final paper requirement
for
next class.
Write a science fiction story.
Write a short story in science fiction.
That would, well, not a requirement, but I would say it would not be a bad idea. Be a sort of a weird idea, but not a bad idea to say that one possible kind of paper for this course is a story of at least X thousand words set in a plausibly worked out future. Right? In a future of the sort, not necessarily one of the ones we've discussed, but of the sort we've discussed. And I've actually gotten, there's a sense in which it's been done. There, one of the past years, in fact, I think I may have given a link to that paper, I'm not sure, but one of the students did quite a good paper, which was in the form of a supposed legal controversy like 40 years from now, where some bioengineers had used human genes in building, in creating an improved vegetable of some sort. And the sort of environmentalist types were claiming that this was cannibalism and that it would bleed blood and so forth and so on. And the question was whether the owners of the genetically engineered, whatever it was, had a case to sue for defamation against the people who were attacking it. So it was, in fact, put in the, in a fictional form. It was put in the form of if this was really happening. And I thought that was really quite fun. I'm trying to remember if I have a vague feeling I've had at least one other story. One other thing. So right, if any of you haven't written your papers yet, if you can think of a way of doing the paper that's in the form of a fiction, that's perfectly acceptable. I'll even smile at you if you do a good job of it, because it's a fun way to do a paper. But everybody should want to write a novel. I mean, just like everybody should want to write a computer program, because, you know, one of the human things is wanting to make machines that work, and a computer program is a machine that works, and you don't have to have a lathe and a soldering iron and a bunch of other stuff. All you need is your computer and appropriate software, and you can write a program. But anyway, that's an irrelevant digression to this current subject. Yes?
So one thing I was thinking about, you talk about space, and you talk about the current dimension that you're living in space. What about if there were more dimensions? I mean, you still got a string theory that's been already
It says 12 dimension is a very odd way of putting it. String theory came along after I left physics, so I don't really claim to understand it. But the fact that a physicist says that in order to describe elementary particles you need more than three dimensions doesn't follow that the science fiction version of the fourth dimension, where it's somehow a parallel reality, really exists. You know, it could be that the rest of the dimensions could be a very different sort of dimension. After all, we do live in a four-dimensional world, the fourth dimension being time. And from a mathematical standpoint, there are lots of things you can describe with more than four dimensions. So you say, here is a picture, and any given point is defined not only by its location in space and time, but also by how bright it is. That's a fifth dimension from a mathematical standpoint in terms of a description of what you've got there, but it's not the kind of dimension you can go hide in. So no, I didn't have anything much to say about that idea. I agree if it did turn out that there were... One of the things that's a little confusing when people talk about a fourth dimension is that what they're really talking about, I think, is not moving into the fourth dimension, but moving through the fourth dimension. The real logic is, if you've got four dimensions, you could then displace yourself in any of them. So if you displace yourself in the one we're not used to, you now have a new three-dimensional universe, just as if you displace from here to here, you have a new two-dimensional universe. All right? So, but... one of the interesting ones, actually, the only one of these things for which there really is some serious scientific basis that I know about is the idea of multiple parallel universes. The idea that, in some versions, every time two things could have happened, both of them do. And the universe works. And there is an interesting book, which I only read part of, but it was by a physicist who was arguing, not unpersuasively, that you could not explain the known facts of physics without multiple universes. That if you think about some of the paradoxes associated with quantum mechanics, his argument at least was that you had to think of a world in which there were all these parallel universes in order to make any sense out of the actual observations. I think it would take it too far afield if I try to reconstruct part of his argument. But if you're curious enough, I'll try to remember to bring in the book on Monday and you can get the citation for it, because it was an interesting argument. It's not clear what the implications are. It's not clear that you could ever do anything with it, as it were. But it is a possible picture of reality. And then, of course, you can write alternate histories in which you're following the line in which Alexander didn't die, and we'll see what happens there. There is, in fact, science fiction novel whose title I've, not science fiction, but a novel I've forgotten, in which clearly the author of it read Mary Renault's three-volume historical novel about Alexander and had the same reaction that everybody else who reads that book has, namely, Renault got the ending wrong. He's not supposed to die. And because, you know, Alexander has this incredible career and then dies young of a disease, apparently, unless it was poisoned, we don't know. And so she rewrote it. That is, she did her version, in which sort of things get changed towards the end in several different ways, and her book then goes on through the next couple of thousand years of steadily developing civilization with this sort of Greco-Roman civilization ruled by Alexander's heirs for the next 2,000 years, if I remember correctly. They're in a satellite in space, as I remember, by the end of it. So that was sort of fun. Same person also wrote another, I think even better, that's another story. That's sort of fun doing alternate history, and it's in a sense is one of the really interesting historical puzzles, which is whether it matters, whether there are sort of two different views of history, one of which says it's radically uncertain. If things had gone just a little differently and Alexander had lived, the world would be utterly different now than it now is. And the other says, no, that's just apparent, but really the big forces would have pushed things the same way, and therefore the world would have been the same. You know, for example, there is an older history somewhere in which Muhammad ends up as a Christian priest, basically. And that, of course, has certain effects on history. Monk, I think, if I remember correctly. But there are other things on the space stuff. Let me just sort of run down, because I really discussed a number of different things in that, and start with L5. All right, people have anything they want to discuss about L5? L5 location, Earth Moon system, stable equilibrium. That's the neat thing about L5. Put stuff there, it stays where it's put. So that would be the obvious place to put a space habitat if you want a really nearby space habitat. No questions. Yes. What? I think it's the same distance as the moon, which is what, 200 and some thousand, isn't it? I think, isn't the moon like 240,000 miles? That's what I'm remembering, but that's my memory. And I think L5, I think L4 and L5, if I remember correctly, are in the moon's orbit 60 degrees ahead and behind of the moon, so that would be the same distance out as the moon is.
So the only benefit not putting on the moon is the gravitational pull on the moon.
Right, the moon has a sizable gravity. The moon, by the way, I don't know if it's occurred to you, but we have a very odd moon. Earth's moon is way too big. If you look at the other planets in the solar system, the relative size of the moon to the planets, I don't remember the numbers, but I think the largest moon relative to its planet is probably like a tenth the size or a 50th the size of our moon. So that you could argue that we don't actually have a moon, that this is a two-planet system, one of them much bigger than the other. And do people understand the tides, by the way? Why is there tide? This is related to the two-planet system. Can you explain that? The puzzle with putting it that way is, why are there two tides a day? It's not our rotating. What's happening is, it's exactly the same point that I made with regard to the space elevator. That when you're above geosync, it pulls one way and below the other. The Earth and Moon are both orbiting the center of mass of the system, which happens to be below the Earth's surface, but out from the center of the Earth. That the result is that on one side of that orbital point, all right? That was sort of deep, and I might have figured that out. Here's the Earth. Here's the moon, and here is the center of mass around that system, and we're both orbiting around it. So this side of the Earth is the gravity, the centrifugal force is overcoming the gravitational force and pushing out. This side of the Earth, the gravitational, the gravitational force. Yeah, because this is moving very close to the center. So this side of the Earth, the other way around. Sorry. This side of the Earth, the centrifugal force, since this is a long distance from the center, is greater, so pushes this way. This side, it's got to be in opposite directions. Let me stop going flat. But basically, the system where both sides of the center of the orbit you push away from, and therefore you get bulges both above and below. But I've got to think about it. I think a little more carefully before I try to offend anybody else, because I did work it out once. All right, so the next thing I was going to mention is the Dyson sphere. Freeman Dyson's clever idea. The Dyson sphere just starts out with how enormously wasteful our present arrangement is. I mean, there's this huge power generator just sitting a mere 8 minutes from us, 92 million miles, and we're just throwing away 99.9-something% of its output. Right? A little bit of it happens to hit Earth, and so we absorb that and make use of that. Well, what a foolish way to run a solar system. So the idea is that as you get a growing, technologically developed society, you start out putting solar power satellites around, and more, and some of them are habitats and other things, and eventually you use it all up, and you have the equivalent of a solid sphere around the sun of human creations. Only it's not going to be solid, it's all going to be moving in different orbits, because solid things raise mechanical problems. And, of course, if it just absorbed that light and did nothing with it, it would get hotter and hotter, and pretty soon it would melt, but it isn't. What it does, it absorbs the light on one side, emits waste heat on the other side. That what we really run on, in a sense, is entropy, not energy. There's this law of conservation of energy. You can't destroy energy, but you can change energy from more useful to less useful forms, and that's what you're doing when you take in sunlight and radiate out in the infrared, and in between you're using it to do all the stuff you want to do. Alright? And then Dyson's brilliant idea was, no reason to assume we're the first people out here. If somewhere there is a civilization that was a mere few thousand years, you think about it, if other intelligent races have evolved, there's been life on Earth for, what, a billion years or so? I don't know if the estimate's currently 2.5 billion, but that kind of magnitude. What are the odds that if another intelligent race evolved, they did it within 1,000 years of us? Right? Very close to zero. So if another intelligent race happened to evolve a little earlier, they ought to have a big head start on us. So how do we find them? Aha! We look for a star that's putting out nothing but infrared, because that's the star where they've already built a Dyson sphere. That was nice. I don't think I found any yet, but I just thought it was a wonderful piece of sort of pure logic that makes its own bizarre kind of sense. And of course, this is then the puzzle. Fermi paradox, I think it's called, which is, where is everybody? Right? If this argument is right, then if the chance of evolving an intelligent technological civilization is anything other than incredibly minuscule, it ought to have happened in this galaxy a bunch of times before, and some of those times ought to be millions of years ago, and in millions of years you can fill the galaxy, even at speed of light limitations. So how come there aren't little green men all over the place? And, you know, one answer is maybe either developing life is just an extraordinarily unlikely accident, or maybe developing intelligence is an extraordinarily unlikely accident, or maybe developing an intelligence doesn't kill itself off is a very unlikely accident, in which case we may not make it either. Or maybe developing an intelligence that develops the technology. After all, our species was here, we don't know exactly, but I think pretty clearly for over 100,000 years before we started doing any of the stuff we think of as technology. Well, maybe most species, it's a billion years. But I think the Fermi paradox is a term used for that puzzle of why they are. So that's the Dyson sphere idea. Another idea, and one which gets complicated, and we may end up with issues for next time, but the economist's reaction to thinking about a solar system civilization of space settlements is, what's property? What is the equivalent of land in that world? And it doesn't make, you know, you're sort of your first conservative instinct to say, well, three-dimensional space. But wait a minute, nothing's standing still. All right, it makes very little sense to say, well, I own this million cubic mile chunk, which your habitat went through in the last tenth of a second. Right? Not a very sensible way of arranging things. And, well, maybe you could own orbits. And that's a little tricky, because, of course, orbits can intersect. And if I own the orbit, does that mean you're not allowed to run into me when you're intersecting orbit? Well, geosync, it makes some sense, because all the geosync orbits are going around together. So it makes some sense to say, well, I own this little tiny bit of geosync. I don't think we've done it that way, but you could imagine setting up property rights for that. Another possibility is solar output. You could imagine that what you own is solid angle on the sun, that I've got the right to collect the sunlight that comes out in exactly this direction. Then you have to have some this direction relative to what, because, you know, it's not all standing still. Anyway, it seems to me it's an intriguing thing to try to apply your mind to say, if we had a civilization where we just took it for granted that that's what we were doing, we were living in that kind of thing, what would be the equivalent of property rights in land? I mean, you have property rights in spaceships, you're fine, they just like property rights in ships. We don't have property rights in ocean, except for territorial waters. And the space is more like ocean. Anyway, I'll let you think about that, but I think it's an intriguing question. We talked a bit about the space elevators already. What about asteroid strikes? Are any of you bothered by the fact that there are near-Earth asteroids which, if they hit the Earth, would make a hydrogen bomb look like a firecracker? And it happened.
Think about it.
It occurred to me before. It just seems like it's a very low probability. I like, though, that what's the Dana Rohrabacher?
Very old friend of mine who I haven't seen for decades.
Yeah, I mean, putting it in private hands, yes, right? Make sure everybody's looking out for him.
When I knew Dana, he was probably a college student, and he was a young libertarian activist folk singer. And strongly supporting marijuana legalization, and I think a user of marijuana, and also very popular with the ladies. It's always useful when you have political movements to have men who ladies led. And he ended up becoming a congressman, conservative Republican congressman. I think he was associated with Reagan fairly early on. Because, yeah, I probably haven't seen him for 30 years or something. But he was. In fact, my first book quotes one verse from one of his songs at the beginning of it. Why can't you see we just want to be free to have our homes and families and live our lives as we please? My first book, not this one. But I thought that was a neat idea.
He wrote an interesting letter. I was just curious who would bring that up. He wrote an interesting letter to someone in NASA expressing serious concerns about what's the piece of project that they have right now that where there is a heavy lift, something where essentially they'll bring something all the way up and then launch it outside. So you're still using some means of propulsion to get it up, not a space elevator, but you're starting to launch it. So he wrote an interesting letter about his concerns as a member of the Tea Party. But, you know, this is something we should consider, but not now. And I just thought this is something.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so actually one of the few things that Obama has done which really sort of resonates with the libertarian Tea Party crowd is that he has to essentially privatized the space project. I mean, I argued for doing that in a book that I published in about 1971. And to some extent he's doing it. I mean, that's on the whole, I'm not a fan of Obama's, but he seems to get some things right. Yeah.
It made a lot of sense to me to have his actual space because if you think about it, and give us an example of the election. Because think about it, when government does things like postal service, we have a mandate for it, but when they developed the zip code system and all the complexity of it, they didn't actually have a department that built the trucks that move around the mail, right? They actually did the higher level thinking of what mail has to be done. So with NASA and like with our aims that they're here, I mean, that's the work that they do. It's more a higher level, not so much rocketry, but actual, you know, the technology that's going to go on.
But the actual building of the, I mean, in a certain sense, in which they never built the rockets, right? They Lockheed and people like that did. But this is pushing it one step further and saying, you're not going to design the rockets either. All you're going to do is to offer to pay people to get stuff up to the space station or to do other things. But of course, you could also argue that that's an argument for a voucher program for schools. That even if you believe the government ought to be paying for the schooling, why should you have the government be producing it? Running schools is also a difficult project. But that would take us fairly far afield. If you're feeling strongly enough in that direction, you might want to investigate the fact that the Santa Clara University Federalist Society is looking for a new head because their current head is graduating and he can't find a replacement. So if any of you want to push sort of conservative libertarian ideas, go find the Federalist Society and volunteer to run it next year. I was just at a talk that they did at lunch, and the guy who runs it was asking people to do that. professors to ask their students if they were interested in doing it, so I've just done so. Yes, you're escaping. Yeah, you've reached escape velocity. Do people understand why, if you're in a satellite in orbit, you feel weightless? Because that's something a lot of people get wrong. Why do you feel weightless? That's the right answer. People say you're outside Earth's gravity. Of course, that's nonsense. Earth's gravity goes as 1 over r squared forever. But the answer is that we're accelerating towards the Earth just as far, fast as gravity is trying to pull you, so you feel weightless the same way you would feel weightless in a falling elevator. It's just that when you're in orbit, you're accelerating this way, but you're moving this way, so you keep missing the Earth and falling around it, as it were. All right, it doesn't fit intuitions very well initially, and yet it's really quite a neat idea that's right. You see, you're accelerating at right angles to the direction you're moving, always. Right? So you start out, you're moving this way, accelerating that way. A little bit, you're moving that way because of this acceleration, accelerating that way. Keep going around. Okay. It's a different way. You could also say the centrifugal force is balancing gravity. But centrifugal force, although it's often a convenient way to think, really is sort of a misnomer because there's nothing actually forcing you. It's an illusion. It's a fictitious force. What's really happening is you're in a non-inertial reference frame for the physics type people here. So asteroid strikes. So what should we be doing about asteroid strikes? What's the obvious thing we should be doing and are doing? Look, right? First, that's of course what Dana was proposing, to privatize. But yeah, should be looking very hard, because one of the nice things about asteroids is they obey the laws of Newtonian physics pretty closely, because they're moving slowly compared to light, and we can predict very accurately where they're going to be. I made that point with that thing, which in whatever 2800 or something is on March, somebody gave the actual date, is expected to make a near-Earth approach. In other contexts, I've argued that usually it does not make sense to bear costs against predicted problems more than a few decades out, because we don't know enough. That's one reason why I'm skeptical about the global warming stuff. But in the case of asteroid strikes, we do know enough so that we can say that with great confidence, this rock is going to come very close to Earth 127 years from now. And now we aren't sure. Maybe 127 years from now, we will all have wiped ourselves out with gray goo, and so we won't care if a rock hits the Earth. And maybe 27 years from now, our technology will be so good that some kid with his toy ray gun will shoot down the asteroid. But it seems to me that the odds that neither of those things happen are large enough so that if you know there's something that you 127 years, you ought to be at least worried about it now and thinking about what to do about it now. And obviously even more true if it's 40 or 50 years, which is... So one thing you do, and that people are doing, whether enough I don't know, is simply having astronomers try to spot near-Earth asteroids and then calculate their orbits. And once you've got where it's been a few times, you can work out more accurately. And then the interesting question is, do you do anything about it? And that probably depends on how soon. If you see something that's going to hit us in 5 years, I can see a real argument for having a crash program to get something up onto it and to try to nudge it enough. Now, you want to worry a little bit, of course, that suppose Al-Qaeda has its program, right? Just think of the terrorist possibilities if you could nudge asteroids. Heinlein, in Moon is a Harsh Mistress, is one of Heinlein's best novels, the weapon the revolutionaries are using against Earth consists of throwing rocks. The revolutionaries are on the moon. And they have a technology that was created for a different reason, but that makes it basically a linear accelerator kind of thing that can throw a mass off the moon, and they can hit any point on Earth that they like, and there's nothing much you can do about a falling rock, and it's roughly a nuclear weapon kind of explosion. But it's a good book. I recommend it for lots of reasons. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. The Moon is a Harsh Mistress. But in any case, so asteroid strikes are one interesting thing to worry about. Other than that, we talked a little bit about interstellar travel and that problem, and solar sails. And solar sails, I'm not sure if they've done it yet or not. There was some talk, at least, about some kind of a solar sail contest that was, I think, going to be in Earth orbit. But and then you could do that if you had launch facilities. But solar sails give you if you imagine a in-solar system civilization, solar sails are a slow but very efficient form of transportation because the only power you really need is just moving, you know, slanting the thing around and maybe fine-tuning the... But basically, your power is all free from the sun. Now, of course, once we finish filling up the solar system, now solar sails won't be permitted because, I mean, that shadow is falling across my solar receptor and my whole colony is shut down for 30 seconds while your gigantic solar sail passed across it. But at least as long as most of that light is getting wasted anyway, you might as well use it so you could use some propulsion. You could then imagine a civilization where it costs very little to get from Earth orbit to Mars orbit, but it takes a year and a half because the push is very, very slow.
The ratio for the solar sail to how much mass can it?
How much acceleration do you want? Do I know what the light pressure is per square kilometer? No. I am sure at Earth's orbit, obviously, it's less as you go further out. I'm sure that number is known by somebody, but I don't know what it is. So that's what you really want to know, is a square kilometer of sail gives how large a force? And the answer is I don't think it's a lot. I think it's like maybe pounds, not tons kind of thing. But you're going to make your sail out of, you know, mylar, the equivalent, out of some very, very thin material, so the mass of the sail is pretty low, and then you need very big sails to move things. But the other thing is that even a pretty slow push, if you can accelerate 24 hours a day, right, a hundredth of a G is roughly 10 meters per second squared. So in an hour is 3,600 seconds. So at a hundredth of a G, in an hour you have a 36 meter per second speed change. In a day, you have almost 1,000 meter per second. In a month, you have something like 20,000 meter per second speed change. So you can 20,000 meters per second is not so slow. So if you think about it, you're balancing the fact that your acceleration is very low with the fact that unlike a rocket ship, you can accelerate all the time.
So as further you get from sun,
the weaker it's going to be.
So it's more than it's going to be the case.
Depends where you're going.
Yeah.
You could, as you, so like something this way, you could, just like a sail doesn't have to take you, a sailboat doesn't have to go in the direction of the wind, right?
Yeah.
If you think about a sailboat, in order for a sailboat to work, you need two forces. The wind itself only gives you one. And then you have the rudder against the water, which gives the other, and the vector sum of those then lets the sailboat go at right angles, or even a little into the wind, the sailboat can do. And you could do the same thing, only the second force is gravity instead. So you could imagine that you slant your sail, so here's the sun, the light bouncing off the sail is pushing you this way, gravity is in, so you're going that way. All right, so you can get essentially at any angle, but the closer to the sun you're trying to sail, the slower your acceleration will be. Just as the closer to the wind you're trying to sail, the lower the force you can get out. This is why you can't have blimps that work as sailboats. All right, a blimp will simply move, assuming it's got no engine, a blimp will be moving in whatever way the air around it is moving. So if you want a blimp sailboat, people I think that this is science fiction do, it's got to be a tethered blimp. You can have a railroad track and a thing running on that and a cable going up to the blimp, that gives you your second force. And now the wind is going that way, but the blimp is going this way. But an ordinary untethered blimp, sorry buddy, it's a neat idea to imagine sails on them, but it doesn't work.
The other thing with solar sails, I did it with collecting a lot of rocks, asteroids,
the asteroid belt is not very dense in rocks.
How many rocks do you need to make it all the energy,
Well, one rock isn't going to make much difference. You're talking about a sail many square kilometers in area, so there's a 10-foot hole in it somewhere. So what? Got to make it out of stuff that doesn't rip very easily, of course. You rip soft nylon, right? Or the equivalent of rip soft nylon. Now my impression is that even the asteroid belt is mostly empty. And I don't know how many small rocks there are. That would be the problem. Big rocks you can navigate around and avoid.
Death by a thousand cuts.
What?
Death by a thousand cuts.
Do you know what the death by a thousand cuts actually is? It was the most severe form of capital punishment in Imperial China. And exactly what it consisted of, it isn't entirely clear. It probably varied from place to place. But it really was a sentence, basically. If you committed a really horrible crime, such as treason, that's what you got. The usual forms of capital punishment were either strangulation or decapitation. And decapitation was much worse than strangulation. Because apparently, your situation in the afterlife was different if your body had been mutilated. So it was actually a more serious capital punishment to be punished to decapitation. On the other hand, most of the capital punishments in Imperial China weren't really capital, because you had a sentence to be for strangulation after the assizes or decapitation after the assizes. And the assizes was a legal procedure in which most people who had been so sentenced got shifted to a somewhat lower non-capital. This is all stuff from my other seminar. I know about it, but it's sort of interesting. Looking at all the different ways human societies have run things. Yep.
Can I ask a question that
sure.
isn't related to the sales?
Right.
When you're talking about how property would work in
yes.
space, how does it currently work with satellites in space now?
That's a good question.
Kind of a worry about satellite pollution.
It's a good question, and I don't think there is a definition of property rights. I think all that's happening is that different countries launch satellites, and I assume when you launch a satellite, you could do your best to figure out it's not going to enter another satellite if you don't want it to. But as far as I know, there isn't. Does anybody know? I don't know of any sort of legal rules defining where you've got a right to put your satellites. I think geosync is the only thing that's crowded, because in general three dimensions gives you a lot of space, but geosync really is not effectively three dimensions. It's really one band going around at the equator at a particular distance out, and therefore it's a good deal easier to run into things. If you think about it, as you add dimensions, you get much, much more space to put stuff in. Some way I did calculations on what populations you could manage in the United States if you have, say, mile-high buildings, which is just getting an extra dimension to put people into. And you get an awful lot of people without having a place look crowded at all. You know, it's still be mostly grassland. It's just interspersed by these, you know, mile-cubic buildings, and a mile-cubic holds a lot of people, even at ordinary. I'll let you do the arithmetic, but if you think about what the volume is of a nice apartment, how many of those would fit in a mile-cube? We tend to overestimate how crowded the world is, and especially how crowded America is, because of a sampling bias, that the places we see are the places where there are people. So we are averaging the average population density averaged by places there are people, not by the whole thing. And the time when you see that's wrong is when you fly across the country and you look out the window and you realize that most of it's empty. But those are the parts you almost never see, because they're empty, so you're not there. Right? That's right, flyover states. It's people who live there put it in a somewhat unfriendly fashion.
So you said that if you quadrupled U.S.'s population, it won't be half as crowded as Germany is today.
That is almost certainly correct. Yeah, that sounds right. A long time ago, back when population was sort of the kind of issue global warming is now, I did some calculations on population density. And that would be, let's guess, 1970. What would you guess were the most densely populated countries in the world at that time? You made a list of about four or five of them. Countries in the world, whole world.
So what was the year again?
1970. I think that's might have been 60. Somewhere around there is when I did the arithmetic. What? No, Japan is not one of the most. Japan is pretty densely populated, but it's not one of the most densely populated countries. Wasn't then, isn't now. Luxembourg wasn't on the list. I don't know. It might be pretty dense. I don't know if I count. I don't know if I had data on the Vatican countries. Belgium, the Netherlands, Taiwan, South Korea, and Singapore.
Netherlands?
The Netherlands. Singapore was the top.
Well, that's a city.
It's a country, too.
Yeah, but what's the ICE?
What?
ICE?
The Netherlands isn't icy. Huh? Netherlands means lowland. What? The Netherlands, noticeable parts of the Netherlands are below sea level at high tide. That's why it's called the Netherlands. You're confusing it with someplace else, maybe with Iceland, with Greenland, with Norway.
No, it's not that. I really thought most of it, I mean, this is my wife. I thought most much of Europe was underneath.
Maybe you were there during an ice age, or maybe you were there in the middle of winter or something. But no, the Netherlands are, you know, they're next to France. They're on the coast near England. Not California, but most places aren't. But it's.
I didn't mean like it's barren, but I thought it was kind of really, you know.
At that time, I looked up the numbers, and you know, we thought of China and India as densely populated. They're very big countries. And so they have a lot of people, sure, but now I should say Hong Kong at the time, which was not a country, had about 10 times the population density of Singapore. And Singapore had, I think, about 10 times the population density of the next densest, which was probably either Taiwan or South Korea at the time. Big gap in the top if you count Hong Kong, but I wasn't counting Hong Kong at the time because it wasn't a country, it was a colony of England. But big gaps in the top and then the next four. And then places like Japan might well have, say, half the population density of Taiwan. It was that kind of... Japan is pretty densely populated, but the U.S. is empty. And Canada isn't there at all. I mean, you know, Canada and Australia are basically empty land with a few people wandering around in terms of population density figures. Now, Canada's not really fair because a lot of that empty land is ice. Right? It's not very usable. And Australia, it's desert, which is why you're so empty, of course, largely. But it was just struck me at the time that people's image was that densely populated countries were dirt poor countries. That list of countries consisted of two rich European countries and three of the most successful developing countries. All right, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and Singapore are all now at roughly European standards. Probably Singapore is probably at European standards. I would guess that Taiwan and South Korea are probably a little below most of the European, but not much. They're the,
starting out at that 71.
Yeah, that's right. But my point is that the sort of popular view was that being densely populated was doom. And in fact, there was not, at the time, there was not a single example of the kind of country people were imagining in the top five. Now, that changed after Pakistan split. Because Bangladesh was in the top five once it existed. When I did the calculation, Bangladesh was part of Pakistan, and Pakistan overall was not. I mean, pretty high, pretty densely populated, but not one of the most densely. But I just thought it was interesting in terms of the perception versus reality, which is very often the case. I mean, this talk that John Lott was giving, he sort of started out with an interesting bit of history, which he was apparently involved at some point as an advisor to, I think, a pilots union that wanted pilots to have permission to carry handguns for protection. This was probably after 9/11. And various people had horror stories about the terrible things that would happen to pilots. According to him, from some point in the early 1920s to some point in the 1950s, every commercial pilot in the United States was legally required to carry a handgun. Not for a good reason. That is what, by his account, what happened was at the very beginning of the period when the planes were being used largely to carry mail. And the U.S. Post Office had these visions of a biplane coming down in a field somewhere and somebody robbing the mails. And so they insisted the pilots had to be armed. And they never got around to changing the rule until like 1955 or something. But his point was just that we think of pilots carrying guns as a sort of weird and radical idea, but in fact it was the universal practice for 30 years or so. And certainly for lots of other things. I mean, you know, we take it for granted that there's a police force. England didn't have a police force till 1830. Right?
That's pretty late.
Yeah. Basically, England in the 18th century, crime was privately prosecuted. it was treated like torque is in our system, except that you didn't get any damage payment, which raises the question why you were bothered. But basically, crime is prosecuted by the victim or somebody working for the victim. There were people called constables, but a constable wasn't somebody whose job it was to find criminals. It was somebody whose job it was to arrest a criminal when the victim went to the constable and said, here, I'll pay you a sum to come with me and arrest this guy, kind of thing. So anyway, another long story, but we sort of tend to take for granted whatever we're used to. But anyway, all right, so I will see you people again Monday, and you will send in issues on space, and you will work hard on your papers, and I expect to see lots of fun papers this year from all you clever people. May 16th, as best I can tell, is the last day of exams, and that's when the papers are due. Email them to me by midnight. As long as they aren't all at midnight, because I want to be able to start working before that. I'm leaving the country on the 19th, and I will hopefully get the grades in before that, but I don't promise that I will.
What?
Leaving the country for 2 weeks, I get back. And then I'll follow the email from that contact, so I can presumably send in grades from Jerusalem or Vienna or Prague, which are the three cities that I plan to be in. All right. I probably haven't gotten it yet.
If you read the instructions that are on the webpage, they explain that you're supposed to do legal research, is one of the topics that we do during the semester, which is supposed to be in by, I think I said, the Monday when, or whatever Wednesday I was, that topic is covered, and it's supposed to be in front of the top few pages, summarizing some part of current law relevant to that. And I have been linking those to the bottom of the topic pages for every week that people are using.
So, obviously I missed that.
Either do it for space if you want, and that's fine.
Okay.
If you had actually done one and somehow hadn't sent it in, you could just send that one in. But if you haven't done one, why don't do one? Find some interesting feature. And you should take a look at the